It's really good to be here. I not to like riff off of the Apostle Paul, but all the ladies on Tuesday nights send their greetings. We love you. We are one women's ministry, one Bible study, and it's our privilege to serve Jesus and to exalt him with all of you. So they send their greetings, and I am thrilled to be here. This was actually the first grown-up Bible study that I attended. I arranged my class schedule in grad school to come to the Thursday morning study, and I was really, really young, and everyone was so welcoming, and some of you are still here. So I love coming on Thursdays. Let's turn to God's Word. But we're not going to turn to Daniel. We're going to turn to Psalm 2. Surprise! Turn to Psalm 2 with me, where we read this. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, as for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Now, therefore, O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry, and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. And then from Psalm 34:3, this is my prayer for us today. Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together. So we are, in a nutshell, fearful people. I didn't know this until this week, but there is a university in the United States that has a department that is devoted to the study of fear. And every year, this university conducts a survey of what Americans fear the most. Recently, they found something interesting, though. When they looked at the survey results, they saw that more than half of the people they surveyed now say that they are either afraid or very afraid of the future. Their conclusion was that Americans today are actually more afraid of everything. This doesn't answer the bigger question, though. If we're more afraid of everything and of the future specifically than we've ever been in the past, according to this survey, what do we do with that? When our future is uncertain and frightening, what do we do with our fear? About 600 years before Christ, Daniel recorded a terrifying vision of what the future would hold for his own people. And looking at that vision, what we see is that God met them in their fear and uncertainty with good news. Today, we're going to look through what you can think of as a gallery of pictures from Daniel 7. And this gallery displays pictures of brutality, majesty, victory, and glory. And through these pictures, we can see that the Bible gives us good news for the future too. We can face an uncertain future because Jesus reigns. But before we tour the gallery, there are a few things we need to do first. If you've ever gotten lost in an art museum, which happens to me with some regularity, you know the importance of walking in the front door and getting a map. So we need to get our map. We need to get our bearings first by understanding the setting for Daniel 7. We find this in verse 1. God's people were an exiled nation. They were experiencing God's judgment instead of his blessing, and exile instead of rest. The northern kingdom of Israel had been defeated by Assyria. The southern kingdom had been defeated by Babylon. And the southern kingdom of Judah had been carried off into Babylon. And that's where we meet a proud king. His name was Belshazzar. Now, when you think of the book of Daniel, there are some children's stories that are maybe more familiar to you than other parts of Daniel. One of those is the story of Nebuchadnezzar. We know that name. It's also fun to say. Nebuchadnezzar, proud king, exalted himself, humbled by God, and then when he was restored, he repented, and he gave God glory. That's the story we're familiar with. Belshazzar, not quite as much. But Belshazzar met God's judgment because, like us, he knew what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. But he refused to humble himself. He was a proud, blasphemous, and idolatrous king. Finally, in verse 1, we meet a faithful servant, Daniel. As a young man, Daniel was taken to Babylon with other young men who showed potential for leadership. This wasn't like being inducted into the National Honor Society. This wasn't an honor. This was actually a war tactic. The goal was to eradicate Hebrew culture and assimilate the Jewish people into the Babylonian Empire by taking the best and the brightest among their young men and pulling them into the Babylonian government. So that's what Daniel experienced. But Daniel, through his long life in exile, remained faithful to God. So we've gotten the map of the gallery. That's our setting. We also need to get a sense for our surroundings. This is where you kind of orient yourself to the space in the gallery. If chapter 7 actually left you feeling a little bit disoriented, you're not unusual. That's because what we read in Daniel 7 isn't like anything that we might read today. And this is a great illustration and a reminder of why we need to understand what we're reading so that we can approach the Bible with the right tools. So, Daniel 7 is an example of apocalyptic literature. When we read it, there are three signposts that can help us find our way through the material. The first is suffering. Apocalyptic literature was written specifically to God's people who were enduring extreme hardship. The second signpost is certainty. The purpose of apocalyptic literature is to encourage God's suffering people, not to puzzle them, to encourage them with the knowledge that God will make everything right again. And it usually points forward to God's final judgment. The third signpost is symbolism. And this is because apocalyptic literature, you may have noticed, relies on vivid figurative language that appeals to all of our senses. So think of it this way. If I tell you, my little friend here, if I tell you that this chocolate chip cookie is good, you might believe me. But if I appeal to your senses, it makes more of an impact. This cookie is pillowy soft. It melts in your mouth. The chocolate chips are silky and rich. When we read apocalyptic literature, although that's a silly example, in a sense, that's what we're meant to do. We're not meant as much to make a neat outline, as much as we're meant to marinate in the pictures that it gives us, to ask ourselves what the images represent, what sounds and sights and smells they evoke. And in a sense, we really should kind of feel all the feels. In other words, reading apocalyptic literature requires us to pause at each picture and experience everything that it has to teach us. So, with the setting and the surroundings in mind, let's look at the first picture we find in Daniel 7. and that's a picture of brutality. Daniel's vision begins with a striking image. We read, "Behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea." In Hebrew culture, the sea represented chaos, terror, and uncontrollable power. Isaiah 57:20, for example, says, "The wicked are like the tossing of the sea, for it cannot be quiet, and its waters toss up mire and dirt." Only God could tame the sea. In another psalm, we read, "God makes the storm be still, and the waves of the sea are hushed." Here, the sea is stirred up not by one wind into a single rogue wave. Here, the sea is stirred up by four winds, or winds from every direction, into a chaotic fury. And out of this fury, three beasts arose. We read later that each beast represents an actual kingdom that would arise and rule, which was a terrifying prospect for the weak, exiled people of Israel. But this also provides a bigger perspective for us. This is an overview of history, a picture of what every human kingdom has the capacity to be: distorted, beastly, violent, and cruel. Each of the first three kingdoms is described here as like a beast. They're characterized by such cruelty that they are essentially beasts rather than human beings. In a sense, we'd see the fall playing itself out as human beings become more like beasts. Now, this should remind us to engage our senses and our imagination here as we ask what these pictures communicate. So imagine a lion ruling with pride and ferocity. And I wrote in my notes here, this is not Mufasa, this is Scar. Imagine a bear, not getting ready to eat, but a bear caught in the middle of devouring its prey and then turning around ravenous for more. Imagine a leopard, strong, aggressive, cunning, and fast, running in every direction in search of what it can prey on. Now, I mentioned three beasts, but you'll notice there are actually four. That's because the fourth one is described here as different from all the beasts that were before it. This beast is not described as like any recognizable animal. This beast is a picture of power, violence, and complete destruction. Notice the action verbs that are used here to describe what the beast does. This beast devours, breaks into pieces, and stamps its prey until nothing is left. The fourth beast is boastful and blasphemous, and nothing can stand in its path. Words do not do this image justice because they're too clean. To get the full impact of what Daniel describes, we have to imagine the sounds, the smells, and the carnage. Imagine the stamping. The fourth beast is terrifying, dreadful, and exceedingly strong. And yet, there's a hint that this beast will not have the final victory. Its dominion was not really its own. It was given to it. In verse 9, there's an abrupt transition. Did you notice that? Almost everything about what comes next is different from what came before. As we move from a picture of brutality to a picture of majesty, we read that thrones are placed. This is intentional, careful activity. And it sets the stage for two scenes that we see. First, we see that the Ancient of Days sits in verses 9 through 12. He does not appear like the beasts did. He has been on the scene all along. The phrase "Ancient of Days" is not a polite way of saying old. I thought of my toddler. I don't think my toddler was any different than any other toddler ever. Every toddler goes through that phase where you have to teach them not to say old man, because there is something we say instead, right? Ancient of Days is not that phrase that we teach our toddlers instead of saying old man. It's a name that communicates dignity and gravity. This is God, and he's eternal. Instead of chaos, there's order. The Ancient of Days takes his seat. Notice that he comes in purity, without a single blemish. His throne is fire, and fire comes out from him. This might remind us of Exodus 19, where we read Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke because the Lord had descended on it in fire. The smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain trembled greatly. The Ancient of Days sits in judgment, and he reigns in majesty. 1,000,000 served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. In an instant, his sentence is executed without argument and without any appeal. As terrible as the beasts were, they cannot stand before the Ancient of Days. The scene is immediately followed by another. One like a son of man comes. The phrase son of man on its own is a Hebrew phrase that simply means human being. But when we look more closely at this figure, we can see that there's more to it than that. Notice how he contrasts with the beasts that were described in verses 2 through 8. Like them, he appears from somewhere else. The beasts come from the chaotic and terrifying sea, but this person comes with the clouds of heaven. This picture should make us think of the glory of God. For example, when God appeared at the tabernacle after he redeemed his people from Egypt, then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. This person is also described in somewhat the same way that the beasts are described. And here's what I mean. The first three beasts are not described as a lion, a bear, and a leopard. They're described as like those beasts. These are human institutions that have become essentially unhuman. But this person who comes with the clouds of heaven is like a son of man. His appearance emphasizes his humanity, but this is a human like no other. This is a human who comes with the glory of God himself. Finally, like the beasts, this person is given a dominion. But the text doesn't stop there. It reads, to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom. The dominion given to the beasts is limited by the one who gave it to them. It ends abruptly when it's taken away in judgment. But the dominion given to this person is different. It's universal. All peoples, nations, and languages will serve him. It will never end. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away. And it is indestructible. His kingdom is one that shall not be destroyed. Again, we step to a different picture, and the focus changes. And if you're paying close attention, you may have noticed that this picture of victory seems a bit familiar. We have a large backyard, and we're surrounded by woods. And it's pretty no matter what time of year it is, even in the snow. But one of the best things about it is that we have a lot of little woodland creatures that are just super cute. They just are. Some of them linger at the edge of the woods, and others hang back, way back in the trees. So the best way that we can appreciate them is to stand at our picture window with binoculars to see who's out there. So when we focus our binoculars on the fox at the edge of the woods, we can see him clearly, but everything else in the yard becomes blurry. When we adjust the lens only slightly, we see the same picture, but it brings different things in focus, like coyotes, speaking of beasts. That's what Daniel's vision is like in these verses. We see it from a new perspective. We adjust the lens slightly, and it doesn't change what's there. But what it does do is that it brings different things into focus. And here, with our lens adjusted, we see that the saints persevere and reign in victory. The saints are the faithful people of God. We're first introduced to them at the end of the explanation that Daniel receives in verses 15 through 18. We read, "Although the four beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth, Daniel is told that the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, forever, and ever." This victory comes after great difficulty. And to emphasize this, the pattern's repeated throughout these verses. In verses 21 and 22, Daniel sees more detail about the fourth beast, the one who's exceedingly terrifying. And he sees that it made war with the saints and prevailed over them. But only until the Ancient of Days entered judgment. Again, in verse 25, we read that the fourth beast shall speak words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and they shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. The beast's reign of terror here is measured out by God's design, and it ends with God's judgment. His dominion shall be taken away to be consumed and destroyed to the end. So with our binoculars adjusted to bring the saints into focus, we also see that their victory is shared with the one like a son of man. The one like a son of man who comes on the clouds with the glory of God himself is given dominion that is universal, everlasting, and indestructible. After persevering through great difficulty, the saints are given this kingdom too. In verse 27, we read, "The kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. His kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him." His victory is theirs. Our final picture is glory. Now this picture, if you go back to our museum analogy, this picture's in a different part of the gallery. And from where we're standing, we can see the outlines of it, but they're blurry. That's where Daniel and the people to whom he wrote would have found themselves. Frightened by the prospect of what lay ahead, and encouraged to persevere because there would be a day of judgment when God set all things right. But they would also have been perplexed. Who was the one like a son of man? How could this person share in the glory that is God's alone? And how could they share his victory? Over 600 years later, the picture came into better focus. In the Gospels, Jesus used the title, the Son of Man, to refer to himself and to his authority. It was like he pulled everything from Daniel 7 together and said, remember all of this? I'm the one that Daniel wrote about. That's how the Jewish leaders understood it, and it offended them. This is what we read in Matthew 26. The high priest stood up and said, "Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you?" But Jesus remained silent. And the high priest said to him, "I adjure you by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." Jesus said to him, "You have said so. But I tell you, from now on, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." And here's the reaction. The high priest tore his robes and said, "He has uttered blasphemy. What further witnesses do you need? You've heard his blasphemy." But Jesus also used this title in another context. In Mark's gospel, we read that Jesus began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed. And after 3 days, rise again. As Jesus moved toward Jerusalem with his disciples, he taught them that the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he is killed, after 3 days, he will rise. Jesus, the Son of Man, was delivered over as our representative. But he rose in victory over sin and death. And with this perspective in view, we can see the picture in Daniel more clearly. We read that the saints shall be given into the hand of the fourth beast. And we remember that Jesus was delivered over too. The people of God suffer, and we do so knowing that the Son of Man has suffered too. We know that by his suffering and death and resurrection, he obtained victory. And that victory is ours through him. One writer puts it this way: "The servants have no kingdom apart from their king. And the king will not reign without his servants." Jesus just cannot stand being separated from his people. But we can still step a little closer to the final picture to see the glory of Christ in beautiful detail. Look with me at what John writes in Revelation 1. I'm looking at verses 12 through 16. "Then I turned to see the voice that was speaking to me, and on turning, I saw 7 golden lampstands. And in the midst of the lampstands, one like a Son of Man, clothed with a long robe and with a golden sash around his chest. The hairs of his head were white, like white wool, like snow. His eyes were like a flame of fire. His feet were like burnished bronze, refined in a furnace, and his voice was like the roar of many waters. In his right hand he held 7 stars. From his mouth came a sharp 2-edged sword, and his face was like the sun shining in full strength." If you've ever seen a composite picture, you'll know that the beauty of the whole thing can only be appreciated by looking at all of the parts and putting them together. That's what John is doing here. We see a description of the Son of Man's head, eyes, feet, voice, hand, mouth, face. But it's as we appreciate each one and then put them together that we see the beauty of the Son in all of his fullness. The parts that John gives us are drawn from Daniel, from Ezekiel, from Isaiah, from Zephaniah. And all of the parts describe the glory of God. And to be sure we don't miss the point that he's making, John uses Daniel's words. This is one like a son of man. And all that God is, he is. The one who would be given a universal, everlasting, indestructible dominion, the one that Daniel could only see from a distance, is Jesus. John saw him, and he was overcome. But Jesus gave him this assurance: fear not. I am the first and the last, and the living one. I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and Hades. That is the truth that makes it possible for us to face the future despite our fears, no matter how significant they might be. Jesus reigns. His victory is our victory. He will reign forever and forever and ever, and we will reign with him. Almighty God, we are thankful for the pictures that you give us in your word, even when they perplex us, because that reminds us that you are God and we're not. We thank you that you've given us your word not as a puzzle for us to solve, not to answer all of our questions, but to remind us of who you are and to remind us that in every detail, your word, through your Spirit, points us to your Son in all of his glory. Lord, I pray that that would be our experience today, that as we come to your word, that we would see Jesus more clearly, that our fears would be stilled by the knowledge that he reigns, and that you would turn our fears to worship, because we worship a beautiful Savior. Lord, help us to see him better for your glory and for the good of all of your people, now and to the ends of the earth and forever. Amen.